Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to episode 62 of the First Exchange podcast with me, your host, Lydia Daydahl. Well, we do always say when we get a really good guest on and we have a really good episode and it's really well received by you guys, the listeners, we're always like, okay, we're going to get that person back on and we'll have a to be continued. So we could not do that and not invite this guest to come in. I was joined today by, of course, the fantastic John Connors. The last time he was on the podcast, he came in first 10 episodes, I think, but the response was absolutely unbelievable. Of course it was. He has so many fans in Ireland and around the world, so we had to get him back in. He's been working on a couple of new projects, so I wanted to get him in to talk about that. And he is the best storyteller ever, so I wanted to pull a few stories out of him for you guys, the listeners, because I know you enjoy that. As always, thank you so much to everyone who always sends in their love via tweets or DMs or email. I read them all and I try to respond to as many as I can. But thank you so much. Thank you for always sharing the podcast and thank you for just being such good supporters of the First Exchange. We really, really do appreciate it. So thank you very much. I will let you all go and enjoy the 62nd episode of the First Exchange podcast with the wonderful John Connors. Welcome back, John Connors.
Thanks for having me again. It's been a long time.
It has. I thought it was a couple of months, but it's actually been 2 years.
It's been 2 years, yeah, and you just assumed I'd know exactly the door and where to go. I thought I was good enough knowing the street. I remember, it's Dame Street near the bus stop.
Do you know what? I'm desperate for it. I have guests all the time saying to me, where am I going? I'm like, shit, yeah, I forget. Minute. Like, they don't know where I'm going. But I thought you'd remember.
Yeah, well, listen, I got the street. Now. That's enough for me. A lot has happened.
So what's been going on?
Well, I'm right now in the edit for my directorial feature, debut in drama. I did one a documentary, End of Sunshine and a Cloudy Day, the documentary, which did great. Went to Rain Dance and still on the festival circuit. Thought to dip my feet in drama. Mm-hmm. And this has been a story that has been circulating with me for a long time. I think I wrote the short originally in 2014. And then once we had the kind of run with Carver Gangsters in 15, I actually applied for funding for the short, got turned down. And then 17, when I had that kind of success with Carver Gangsters and being the writer on that, I thought it's an ideal time to apply for funding with it. And then I did, and I got rejected again as a short just. And so I said, what can I do here? And eventually, when I teamed up with Turner Williams, who was the co-owner of Cluster Fox Films, we have a company together, good friend of mine, and we're writing teams. I asked him just to write this into a feature with me, because Tiernan's a cognitive scientist and a psychotherapist, so no one else would know more about trauma, which is the central theme of the film. So we wrote it as a feature, and then we presented it to the funding bodies again in its newest feature form, and again it was shot down, and we didn't apply for funding, but we were just told unofficially that it's not the type of film they want to support, which made me want to make it even more.
Yeah, of course.
A bit of resistance always helps me. And so I just kept putting it out there and just putting it out there into the world and hoping something would happen. And I was on a radio show, I think it was Nova or something, and I mentioned this film that I just can't fucking get funded. And no one wants to touch it because it's about the institutions and the power of corruption and all that kind of stuff. And basically someone got in touch with me and just said, John, this is really interesting. And he was an admirer of my work and activism and stuff. And he said, John, would you follow me? And I just needed to DM you about something. So that led to the conversation and eventually brought us to the point where he funded the film.
Incredible.
So, yeah, the universe
aligned.
That's
the kind of dream, isn't it? That, like, this random figure would just come out of nowhere and be like, I want to support your project.
Absolutely. And look, it's a low budget, a micro budget, as they would call it, but it was enough to get it made. But the craziness, like, just began because, I mean, we're one of maybe only two, and the only one that continue through level five lockdown. Like we were, so like nearly a third of our budget went to just COVID practices. So we were low enough budget to start, and then you talk about the fucking the bad weather we got, the just the craziest shoot ever, the most stressful thing of my entire life times 10.
Really stressful.
Yeah, like I had actors nearly walking off and all.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not and I had a great relationship with my actors, but for various other reasons and stuff, and people, and there's a lot of serendipity surrounding the role as well for some actors. They were kind of meant to do this, you know. Like I'd met Paul Rowe, who was the lead in it, and Jimmy Smallhorn was the original lead. He was a good friend of mine. He was a great actor who played Git in Love Hate and who played Dara in Carver Gangsters Who Killed Me. And Jimmy had a bit of, let's say, the opposite of serendipity is blanity. So he had a bit of bad luck and bad fate coming together. And Jimmy had to back out of the role. And I thought, how the fuck am I ever going to cast this role, you know? Because you need someone in around that age, kind of mid-50s. And he needs to have had struggle in his life, like real struggle, and to be a natural actor as well. And I met Paul Rowe, who had worked with Ann Garber Gangsters. And the whole weird thing was I wanted to make this because my grandfather went to an industrial school and I wanted to sort of just explore that, the sort of generational impact of that. And I met Paul, and the first thing Paul said to me, my father went to Letterfrack Industrial School, which is the one my grandfather went to.
Wow.
I went, what? And he said, my grandfather too. And my uncle.
Wow.
And I just knew right there and then that was the role for him. But I knew he had to go to hell and back. Mm-hmm. It was the only way to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hell doing that suit. It was hell. And it tested me to my absolute max in terms of my empathy, in terms of my problem solving. And but the thing is, if you look at what we're making a film about, this intergenerational trauma, inheriting trauma and clerical abuse and all these dark subjects, I mean, it was never going to be a doddle anyway. And we had to shut down 2 weeks in, or 4 days in, because we had a COVID scare, and then it's hard that we didn't, blah, 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 which killed our budget. And then we had to restart 2 weeks later, which ended up being the best thing to happen to us, but we didn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a hard one to keep together. And, like, I had to email everybody and just say, listen, look at the film we're making. Look at what this is about. If this is easy, we haven't done our job. This is going to be hell.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So... some of the actors had to go to fucking dark places, like, you know. And I learned so much about fucking acting from watching these other actors as well, being an observer and just getting the fuck out of the way, you know.
When you say dark places, do you mean within themselves as actors?
For sure, yeah.
Like, this might sound really stupid, but give us an understanding of what you mean by that. Because I think we don't really, we kind of just see actors as, you know, that it's, I don't even know how to explain it. Like, we just see you in the final product. So we kind of just think that it's a very simple, easy process for you. You just learn the script and then you add a little bit of flavour to it.
Well, I can tell you, I've done a lot of jobs in my life and a lot of different stuff and went through a lot of stuff. And I can tell you, the hardest thing I've ever done in my life is try to cultivate a good performance, which is what I give in Carver Gangsters. Objectively, a good performance. That wasn't a great performance. It was a good performance. And it was good enough for me to win loads of awards and whatever, but it was just good. That's my opinion, and I can be objective. That was so hard to do that. Because acting is a craft, and I hate when it kind of gets too, like, arty-farty about it and whatever. Because I think we need to get away from that. And I don't think just because you're doing a thing that is deemed as an art that you are doing art. I don't think just being an actor means you're an artist. Being a painter means you're an artist. I believe that the craft has to transcend and get to a certain level.
Okay.
And it becomes art. You know, so you have to get really good at the craft first. And then you can transcend and make art. That's what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with acting, to get to those places, there are kind of three kind of dominating spaces, practices that you can apply. So there's the what we know as the Lee Strasberg method or method acting. That came from the Stanislavski system, right? Konstantin Stanislavski, who was a Russian actor and director 130, 40 years ago. And one day was on stage and found that he had a moment of truth on stage, right? Something changed, something clicked. And he said that he discovered this method. He didn't invent it because he believes whenever an actor ever performed with truth, that was this system that he created, essentially, but again said he discovered. Now, what came from that was the sort of New York acting boom And the method. So Lee Strasberg studied under Stanislavski and was influenced by him, and he created his own method from that, and that became now what we know as method acting, in which he tried to embody the character and tell the truth. And there are different ways of doing it. So under Stanislavski, there's that Strasberg, but then there's also Stella Adler. So Stella Adler would have taught Marlon Brando and De Niro. Strasberg would have taught Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman. Then there's Meisner, who would have taught Rockwell and many other great actors. And so there are three different practices. So they all stem from Stanislavski, but they have different outlooks of how to get to that place, that dark place. So what Stella Adler believed is that you use the circumstances of the script or the play to get there. So use those circumstances. So embody yourself into the character and use that and go to that place there emotionally through that. Strasberg believed the original Stanislavski method, which is kind of debated on whether he switched his mind in later years or not, which is using emotional recall, so your own trauma, reliving your own trauma. Now, that can work and it can not work, and then it can, you know, and it can do damage to you because you're reliving trauma. You're torturing yourself without a professional around you, you know what I mean? And then there's the Meisner technique, which is use imaginary circumstances, so any circumstances that would get you to each. So I, as an actor, would use all of them. I would just go through it, whatever's kind of working for me. I used to fixate on my own trauma and the emotional recall of the Strasberg method, and then that just fucks with your head. And then sometimes it just doesn't work because you just get an empathy fatigue, you know. And then I've used the circumstances of the character and then to empathize with the character, and that has worked, and then sometimes it hasn't. And then other times it's just created circumstances as imaginary for what Meisner did. So with these actors, they're kind of they're using one method or the other, and they're getting to the sort of that place. And you're watching it, and you're watching how they were getting there and how they're grown. And for me as a director, it was a delight. I learned so much as an actor. And then as a director, because for me, it's about handing the power over to the actors. Making them realize, not me giving, making them realize that they own the characters. I don't own the fucking character. You own the character. If you empower actors with that, well, then they'll go anywhere for you, and they'll go anywhere for the character. Whereas if you try to construct their performance and you stay on them and you're micromanaging a performance, you're killing the creativity, and then things become very structured and dull. And I've seen this and I've witnessed this and I've been directed like that. So the key is to just give them total freedom, realize they own it. I'm not the sum of all. I'm not all the answers to everything, you know. I declare that with them, you know. And for me, it's about, I don't think there's, as a director, I didn't have like a super micro specific vision. I had a vision that was constantly evolving and becoming more beautiful, and serendipity taken over, and spirituality is taken over, and we're being guided in some way. And we roll with the punches no matter what. We roll with them no matter what. Don't ask no questions, just keep going. So that's what the whole process was like. And I learned so much about myself, and just, it relit everything for me again. Just brought all the passion back again, you know?
It sounds like I'm totally sold by what you're saying.
Well, look, it's a dark subject, but I mean, the approach we take, like we're, it's a, let me give you a little bit of synopsis on what it's about and what the Black Wealth means. So the Black Wealth were a group of people in ancient Rome that wanted to uphold the power of the Pope.
Oh, fizzy.
I thought sparkling would be a good idea to counteract with the coffee. But anyway, we'll have to get a cleaner in there. Do you have a budget for a cleaner? Anyway.
We should have champagne, to be honest.
Fuck that.
I'm off
I
the
can't
drink,
stop.
Though.
I can't stop. Give me a bottle of champagne. I'll be looking for a bottle of vodka an hour later. So the Black Wealth were a group of people in ancient Rome.
Yeah.
They wanted to uphold the power of the Pope. They were essentially Pope loyalists. And they wanted a Pope to run the economics of Rome. Now, the White Wealth were the opposite. They fought against that. So if you fought against the Black Wealth and you were against the Pope, essentially you'd be banished or massacred or killed. And they were pretty bad people. Now, Virgil, the famous Italian poet, was banished by them. Now, Virgil was the poet that wrote Dante's Inferno.
Right.
So we're kind of doing a loose sort of urban tale, a modern day of Dante's Inferno. And what we're saying with the Black Wealth is that the Black Wealth is essentially Ireland, the state of Ireland, not its people. The state that chose to uphold the power of its institutions over the interests of its people. So it's putting the state and its institutions on trial, essentially. And it's about a middle-aged addict who goes back to visit his old industrial school. And he's confronted with his trauma. And he's confronted with his family and his neglect and all the bad things he's done and his guilt and his shame, which is ingrained in everyone. We all have our own guilt. We all have our own shame. I suppose he'd have an extreme sense of that going through what he did. And then this thing of abandonment and abandoning his kids. So it's about sort of the life script that we might have talked about this before, but we're all born with our own life script, and 95% of people stay on that script. And the script is written by your parents and your uncles and your aunts and your cousins and your friends and your environment and your teachers and whatever. And most people stay in line with that life script. And I suppose what he's trying to do is life in this point in time when we're meeting him, this kind of nuclear time, he's trying to rip up that life script, and he's either going to recover and find an awakening, or he's going to die literally, figuratively, spiritually, emotionally, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the setup for the film, yeah.
So good.
We'll see.
It is sure to ruffle a few feathers as well.
Oh, it's going to do that. It's going to do that. You have no idea. And listen, you know the thing, like, I do be, people call me controversial, right?
Yeah.
And I do get it, because I'm not stupid, like, and I can be objective. I get it totally.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not being controversial to be controversial, like. I'm genuinely not.
You're following your truth.
Look, I genuinely am, and that's just who I am. And I am the sum total of every single human being I've ever met and had an experience with.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe people say I'm a contrarian. They can say that too. I mean, because I think you're being told to kind of line up one way or another. And if you don't line up in a straight line, then you're being a contrarian, or you're a hypocrite, or you're this or that. And what I've decided to do is, like, just step away from all that stuff politically, as in, just that literally being there fighting with a mic in your hand and all that. It's the lowest common denominator for me on a spiritual level. Do you know what I mean?
Why do you say that?
Because you won't affect change like that, right?
Okay.
They say cream rises to the top. In politics, sewage rises to the top. And that's what happens. And when you put yourself out there, you put yourself up for attack, and you got to be willing to take that, and that's just the way it is. But I don't think the reward for that is there. And it took me a long time and a sort of metamorphosis to realise that. I had inklings of it. I was told it, but it wouldn't go in, you know. And I'm a very open-minded person. But it took me a while to understand that that is just not the way. It's not the way for me. So what I'm doing now is putting absolutely everything into art, everything into creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And since I moved out and moved in with my friend Tiernan, like, we've done a ridiculous amount of work, like, during COVID, and filmmaking and writing and acting and everything. I've just fucking said yes to everything and went and done everything and just threw myself into it. And I'm finding I'm growing so much as a person, so much as a fucking artist. I'm accessing things that I used to struggle to access.
Mm-hmm.
And now what's happened, things are kind of coming together for me. And now when this film comes out, it's going to be like a bomb dropping because of what we're doing in it. And then the conversation will arise from that. And then I'll talk around that.
This is what I was going to ask you, in that, you know, you're saying that that's not how you know, standing with a mic in your hand is not how you invoke change. So what I wanted to ask, and especially when you were going through, like, describing about everything that yourself and the cast have been through over the last couple of weeks, what is it that you hope from the viewer to happen when they watch your film or they watch your project or they, you know, what do you want the outcome to be?
Very simple. Healing.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I've realised that, and I've known it as well for a while, but I'm becoming more aware of it. So when you become super aware of something and you don't lose sight of that, is, then you can stay on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I got into acting and art and creativity. Like, I got into creativity as a kid. I was, like, I mean, I looked at it. I watched the Jordan Peterson thing recently. It was an hour talk on the psychology of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And this journalist asked him, how would you create the perfect creative? How would you do that, you know, as a kid?
Yeah.
What do you do as a parent to support your child in creativity?
Yeah.
And he said, unfortunately, none of that'll work. He said, the more you support that and all of it, none of that will work. He said, you want to know how you create the perfect creative? Someone is going to be really creative. He said childhood trauma. He said, ugh, have them lose a child before 10, he said. He said, you want to go further? He said, have them lose a mother or father before 10. Have it go further. Have them lose that mother or father through suicide. And it just hit home with me because I lost my father.
Since of course, yeah.
And it hit home with me because what happens is the creativity kicks in because you've been confronted with the hardest question of all, the hardest problem of all to solve, which is overcoming that trauma and making sense of that suicide, making sense of that loss and that grief. So you don't even understand it at that time. It's your unconscious. And I can see it now throughout my whole life. So when acting came around, there was this huge moment of fucking catharsis and inner fucking healing. And when I fucking tour around the country or the world doing me one man show, like I get healing from that.
Yeah.
Major healing. Like, and what is, I concentrate on people and that I hope someone comes to the show tonight that wants to see the show, that needs to see the show. Someone is going to find something from this show. And then it goes the opposite way. Like, I think I told the story before, but my grandfather, who died about a year and a half ago, was essentially my father, took over from my father and my hero. I looked after him the last 6 months of his life because I was literally living next door to him, along with me and other family members. But every day I gave him his medication and I looked after him and I tried to give him a bit of dignity and debt because he didn't want one of his daughters doing it, and you know, that kind of thing and whatever, gender thing and, you know, a daughter seeing certain stuff and whatever. So,
yeah.
So I just thought I need to keep it strong and I need to just fucking give him his dignity. That's the best thing. He gave me so much and learned me so much. And that's all I can do and just give that to him. And he was getting anointed by the priest. And I got a phone call from the Darndale Rehab Centre. And I hadn't done my show in maybe 4 or 5 months. So you kind of lose the lines and whatever and you're just not sharp or whatever. And what I'd forgotten was I agreed to do a show for them. And they called me and they said, John, are you ready to do the show? You're on stage in 15 minutes.
15 minutes?
Yeah. Now, to put into context, I hadn't slept in 3 days. I was just drinking coffees because I didn't want to miss my grandfather's death. And I was strung out in coffee, smoking a bazillion fags, voice fucked, just physically, emotionally, you mean, like couldn't be more destroyed. And I just didn't want to miss his death. And, but what am I going to say at this Darndale fucking rehab centre? Like, am I going to say no? So I couldn't say no. So I said, yeah. And he said, look, can you get over in 15 minutes? And I said, okay. So I got to the place, got to the door, was confronted with a couple of the counsellors, therapists. They obviously could see right through me, could see what was going on. And I said, look, this is going to be an absolute car crash. I'm telling you that. But I'm not going to let you down. I'm going to try. But just know that. So I don't even know if I know the lines. I have no energy. I don't know where this is going to go. Emotionally, I'm very unstable right now. And they were like, oh, Jesus, are you sure you want to do it then? And there was like 35 people, addicts in the room, like, we're all looking forward to it. From my area, you know what I mean? And I says, don't ask me, Monsieur, just let me do it. Just give me 2 minutes. And I just got myself together. I was like, oh, my God, what the fuck? Calm the anxiety down, taking a panic attack. And I walked onto the kind of make-do stage that they meant for me. And I said the first line of the show. And I used the anxiety to kind of incorporate into the, so I did a kind of different performance and they all started to laugh and I fed on the laughter and I started improvising and kind of using terms and colloquial terms that you'd know from the area and kind of references. And before I got into the play, I just basically did 10 minutes of stand-up without even realising it, you know, that kind of way. I just kept feeding for the laughs and they kept laughing and the 10 minutes of laughter fucking fueled me like fucking like an energy injection. And then I did the show. And the show is normally, you saw it, it's 55 minutes or whatever, 60 minutes. So we ended up doing like a 70-minute show. And by the end of it, they all gave me a standing ovation and they were all crying. And I start crying. And they were all thanking me. And I said to them, like, I said, you don't understand. I said, I hope you got something out of this, but I can tell you, you did so much for me. This saved me. I needed this one. So thank you. You have no idea what that meant to me. And we all start hugging each other. And that is what art is about. It's about community. And it's about love. You know what I mean? Love and spirituality and connecting with each other. And I know they're all fucking cliche, fucking wanky hippie things to say. But it's the truth. And when you find that, you know that's all that fucking matters. That's all about, and everything else is fucking immaterial. It doesn't matter. So career-wise now, is just focusing on that love, that spirituality, that healing. And with this film, I hope that, first of all, it'll rattle some cages. It questions people's beliefs. I hope it gets people angry.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened in this country under the rule of the Catholic Church was catastrophic for us as a people and for the collective Irish soul. And we haven't dealt with it. We're the greatest in the world that we're oppressing our emotions. And we say, like, we're a pretty liberal society now. But I think that's really just a cult of liberalism, because I think we're really repressive and we don't actually like talking about stuff. And we're maybe good at talking like we want to talk about stuff now, which is a step. So with this film, I hope it gives people healing. And the people who went through that and recognised that, or had family that went through that, I hope they feel like they've been represented, that they've been given a voice. So, big hopes.
No doubt that they will. But it's interesting what you mentioned there about generational trauma.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a hot topic for me at the moment, where I'm trying to understand how to heal personal generational trauma that I don't particularly know about.
Yeah.
Which I've just found out is actually a thing, where I was like, well, that doesn't help anyone. So what is your understanding of generational trauma and how it affects us as an individual?
Well, even if it's stuff you are not aware of, it's going to affect you, because it's going to affect the people who are aware of it.
Yes.
And therefore, it's going to shape you and have a ripple effect on you.
Yeah.
Because a great predictor of future behavior is past behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That's basic psychology. And with trauma, that shapes your behavior and where you're going to go and see. Not dealing with trauma. I read this quote from Jacques Lacan, who was like sort of the third giant of psychology and psychoanalytics. There's Freud and then there's Jung and then there's Lacan, which they say went back to Freud, and he kind of went back to kind of Freud's philosophies. And this quote floored me because it's so fucking true, and it's simple, and it's what isn't said becomes a symptom. Now, if Jacques Lacan was alive today, Jacques Lacan would be called someone far right, even though he's far left that time.
Yeah.
It's and what I mean, because he was free speech, you know, because, and all psychotherapists are mad free speech. Of course they are, because they don't believe in repression, because repression is the worst thing you can do to yourself. Not resolve stuff. Anything that is unresolved is going to have catastrophic circumstances there for you. So you have to resolve the stuff that's going on inside you. In your unconscious, you have to tap into that. You have to say what you're not willing to say. You have to. Or it's all going to come out in your behaviour. It's going to come out in your self-destructive behaviour. I'm a perfect example of it. I've done this my whole life. I've ignored all my trauma my whole life. Listen, this is how mad we can go, and this is how fucking oblivious we can go to our own traumas. I'll use myself as an example. At about 17, I took a fucking mental breakdown and was fucking doing mad shit. And I was extremely violent. Extremely, right? And I never bullied anybody, but if you give me an opportunity, I'm breaking your jaw. And I was 17. No, genuinely, and it's not a brag. It's a horrible thing to say.
It's so separate from the person that I know and you
yeah,
right now.
But
you
I'm
know?
17, so it's a long time as well. You have to learn through life not to break people's jaws and get your own jaw broken, you know what I mean? But so I had, first of all, before my father died, I had found my father trying to commit suicide, right? Images I'll never forget. Saw a lot of mad shit. And then finally he killed himself. And then when he killed himself, me and my brother Joe started getting bullied by their travelling young fellas. And he'd say, your daddy killed himself and blah, blah, blah. And we were fighting literally every day. Every single day me and Joe fought on our way to school. After school, we were getting bullied because we'd never back down, because our father told us never back down. So unfortunately, that seed that he planted for us to never back down resulted in us getting bad beatings, because we'd never say we're bet. So we were beaten to bloodied and like to a pulp at times, you know, and hospitalised sometimes. So we'd never stop. We were relentless. And then adults would bully us because they could take advantage of us, because we never had a father, especially in the travel community and all that and stuff. So adults were coming at us, and everyone was coming in. Then with school, we were being called knacker and pikey by other kids and even teachers, right? So we were getting trauma left, right and centre. So I joined boxing in order to become a man and fight back and whatever. Mm-hmm. And within 6 months, I won a lot of titles and I knew it was a natural at it and great and whatever, and I gained loads of confidence. And I thought it was going to be professional boxing, that was going to be my career and whatever. So I hit about 17 then, and there were a few events of trauma as well that got me in a dark place, but there was something unexplained that I couldn't get to. I just couldn't understand what was happening. There was something bubbling underneath me and thoughts coming into my head, and I was going, where the fuck is this all coming from? And not for one second did I think that had any connection to my father, to my bullying, and to everything that happened to me up until that moment. Not for one second. And if someone mentioned, I would think that's ridiculous, and I'd call them a posh American for thinking that. Do you know what I mean, Lydia? That's how much we can ignore trauma.
Yeah.
When that was my behavior was the exact result of my trauma. And I was a reasonably intelligent 17-year-old, and that couldn't get through to me. That's how good we are at fucking repressing our emotions and trauma, and especially in this country called Ireland.
Mm.
We're pros at it. I mean, if you look at colonialism, what colonialism was oppression and repression too, you know? And then the Catholic Church was another rule. That was colonialism. Mm-hmm. You know, that was oppression, and we repressed everything too. You know, and these doctrines, like, that doesn't, like, we're talking about the intergenerational trauma and all that. Even, like, it's not long ago that Catholic rule, if you want to call it that, ended in this country, you know.
Mm.
And our family and parents and grandparents behaved in a different way than us.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back to the idea of trauma, of course that's going to, even if you don't know about it, of course it's going to affect you because it shaped the person before you in a certain way. And they behaved in a certain way towards you because of that trauma.
Yeah.
So you're inheriting that trauma. That's a fact. That's basic science. That's psychology.
Fuck.
You know what I mean? But that's why it's important to fucking...
How do we heal as a society? Well, how do we heal?
Unfortunately, there is healing, right? But unfortunately with trauma, we never get over trauma.
Yeah.
We have to understand we never really get over it. Trauma's always going to be there. It's how to deal with the trauma. Recognize when the trauma is causing you to behave like this.
Mm.
So see the connections and then stop that. That thing is always going to be there. You know what I mean? And it's just about that going towards the light.
Mm-hmm.
But we're never going to be perfect, and no one is perfect, and no one has a perfect life. And everyone from every background, whether you're rich or poor or in between, goes through trauma. That's just the reality. But just being made aware of your actions and how your trauma has fed its way into your life and your behaviours.
So obviously acting and being creative has been an outlet for you to help you heal to a certain degree. But was there anything else? You know, you've got so much wisdom when it comes to like looking at the psychology of yourself and of others. So where did that come from? You know, did you go to therapy? Did you read books on it? Like, how did you heal?
I don't know if I'm healed. That's the thing. Like,
you're still healing.
I'm still healing, yeah, of course. Like, but I'm still on this journey. And I fall off track and I jump back on track. Mm. Because it's not like these American fucking films in that, oh my God, this one moment that changed my life. There's none of that. I mean, what does Socrates say? You might have to fail 1,000 times in order to succeed.
Yeah.
And it's something like that. And I'm hoping that fucking me 1,000 times will find fucking
what beautiful. Makes you fall off the wagon of, you know, being honest?
My triggers, which are, these are not like micro triggers or anything. You know, you know, like we all have our triggers, and and I don't mean that in the PC sense. Dealing with a lot of stress, definitely does something to you. And then family stuff that happens, that's big for me. And then seeing people's behavior around me, and I know where it comes from.
Yeah,
it kind of triggers my own behavior, and then you sort of mirror that behavior. And you realise that you're all fucking doing it unconsciously then, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then you start fucking whatever, I might excess drink then for a bit, or, you know what I mean? Mm. So, look, it's not, what I'm finding is, I'm showing progression in that the falls are becoming less and less. So mm-hmm. they're happening less and less, the little fall off tracks, they're happening less and less, and they're not as extreme, and I'm pulling back the extremity of them. Because I'm very extreme. That's the problem.
Yes, we've talked about this before. We both have a touch of the extremity.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, that's a creative thing as well. And look, it's what, going back to the Jordan Peterson thing, is what he said. If you want to make a real, true creative, make their parent die before they're 10 and make sure the parent die choose suicide. And he said, you're going to get someone really creative. But he said, you're also going to get someone who's going to be have a chaotic life. It's a perfect prescription for a very bad life. So it's about falling in between, you know what I mean? And trying to find that fucking balance of that, this fucking balancing thing I'm trying to find out in my life. But trauma is so hard to get away from, and it's mad because it's in those acute moments, those moments when you're drinking or you go too far and whatever, that's when it all comes back. It all comes from the back to the forefront of your mind. And it dominates your thoughts then, which makes the next end of that session or whatever it is, hell.
Yeah.
You're going to hell. You know, there's the concept, Jack Lacan has the concept of the real. It's like the shadow kind of thing that Jung has. But the real is, there's the real, there's the symbolic, and there's the imaginary. So the imaginary is where I like to play, obviously, and it's in creativity, and it's, but the imaginary is ignoring a lot of stuff that's going on as well. You know, and what happens is sometimes you get out, you get sort of fatigued from that, you fall into the symbolic. And when you fall into the symbolic, you kind of lose language. And you see, sometimes you might get a bit depressed or anxiety. Your language starts to deteriorate a bit. You get a bit blah, 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 blah. Do you ever get like that?
Yes.
Well, so that's you being in the symbolic.
Yeah.
And that's you trying not to fall into the real, which is the real you and the darkness and the depth of you. Because we all have a persona.
Yeah.
And our ego, our persona, whatever you want to call it. But that's shaped in how other people think of us.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So that is fake. And the true us, when we're left with the true us after a 3-day bender and we're looking at the ceiling, you're in the real and you're left with your true self because your ego's gone.
Yeah.
And it's hell because you've delivered your true self.
Yes.
And we're capable of dark things and the worst of things. But most people ignore the real and never go there. Most people just go around whistling and are happy enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you're trying your best to stay away from the real. And sometimes as an actor, you have to go to the real to drag something up, you know. And that's why you get so many actors fucking suffer depression or they go suicide or get a, because they go into the real or they embody their shadow. They become aware of their shadow. You know what I mean? So you're trying to stay away from that and trying to stay in the imaginary. And imaginary is great. That's fun, you know what I mean? I prefer to stay in that, you know what I mean? It's all about imagination.
It really is. But what I want
to... So back to what I'm saying.
Go on, yeah.
I've learned it all just through life and then meeting certain people along the way. And I've taken every bit of information I deem as important is stored there somewhere in my brain.
You have a mad old brain, John.
But
like,
anything
you remember a lot, like...
I only remember the important stuff, right? It's funny you say that, but some of my really good friends, like, they'll just go, how do you not remember that? It's not important. You know what I mean? Whenever I go, this is important... Or I kind of, if I meet an interesting person, I'll interrogate them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because if you look at somebody, like you meet somebody on the street where they're 30 years of age. To me, I look at them like a 30-year-old book.
Yeah.
And they're the expert of that book.
Yes.
You know what I mean? They've so much to give you. So it's weird because I love listening. This, I'm on here talking, but I love listening. And I Tiernan Williams, who we're with Cluster Fox together, meeting Tiernan was a huge thing for me because he's a psychotherapist and a cognitive scientist. And the first few months we were working together, I was working under him as a support worker for this kind of sort of addiction program. And in reality, I probably should be on the fucking program. But he was the manager, and he's from Ballymun. And I looked at him like my own sort of class bias, and I'm from the bottom. And I'm going, you're from Ballymun, and you have a master's in psychotherapy and cognitive scientists. Like my own snobbery, you know what I mean?
Yeah, which
I checked, but I said it to him. I said, I bet you get it because you're like a unicorn. You know what I mean? And then he was like, and then I was getting paranoid. I was going, oh, he's psychotherapy. He's picking up everything. You know what I mean? And I was like trying to just say nothing to be cool for about 6 months, you know. And then one day, I just started interrogating him a bit and asking him about stuff and stuff that was flying around my own head. And then he was telling me about this gestalt therapist. His name was Gestalt.
Right.
And it's this sort of improvisational psychotherapy. Really fucking crazy shit, but fucking profound. Profound.
Right.
And I said, are you trained in that? He said, yeah, because he's an integrative psychotherapist. So I'll learn all the methods.
I need
the
to get
Jung.
Him on this podcast.
Yeah, you should. He's learned the Jungian method, Freud, fucking Lacan, you name it, all them gestalt. So he can literally slip into each one of these and do therapy in either one depending on his patient, you know. So I said to him, being real sceptical, I said, that's a lot of bollocks, the Gestalt thing, yeah. And I said, all right, yeah. I said, do a bit of Gestalt on me, I said. Right? So I'm there with Tiernan and then another girl who was working there. And he said, ah, man, you know, you don't want to do it, you know. So I said, do a bit, like. And what I didn't realise that his psychological evaluation of me was what was going to make that work. And yeah. I didn't even realise he had this down on me already. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we sit down facing each other and he asked me a question. And he said, because he knew it's all around what he already knows about me and what he's trying to get out.
Yeah.
And there's a few different methods like this that are freaking out. It's like you would think it's psychic. It's that accurate because he's such a sharp fucking tool. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, but he said, imagine there's someone next to you. It can be anyone at all, but don't tell me who it is. Now, what made me say this person to myself was the fact that I wasn't going to have to say who it was.
Yeah.
This is how he got me.
Right.
So I imagined it was my father.
Yeah.
Which I don't know where it came from, but what that meant was he had an evaluation of me in which he knew, this is 7-8 years ago, which he knew I was repressing everything got to do with my father.
Yeah.
But if he gave me the permission not to say who it was, I was going to put him in that chair.
Yeah.
Right? That's what I realised later on from just digging into his head and learning from him.
Yeah.
So then he was saying, what would you say to that person? And then I went, what? Say something to that person. And I went, oh, that's going to give it away.
Yeah.
And then I thought, then he said, what would these say to you right now and the way you are in your life? And I just broke down and cried.
Oh, John, it was our fucking crying.
Yeah. And that was in not messing. That was 60 seconds. So that was that was about 7-8 years ago. So now he's one of my best friends and I live with him. So you can imagine how much I've learned from him. Do you know what I mean?
Shit.
So he paid for his education for mine as well.
That's such a good practice, you know, to even do that yourself at home, you know?
Yeah. So I learned a lot from him, to answer your question. And other people along the way, you just take from people. Like,
what's their sign, is he?
I don't know. He wouldn't believe in that shit.
When's his birthday?
He wouldn't believe in that.
He's not coming on the podcast. No, that is like, that's huge. That's got such an impact, even to just like put yourself in that position. And like, how are you in those vulnerable moments?
How are you? Yeah.
Yeah.
You could break down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or when, do you ever see when you're going through a struggle and someone shows you a bit of love?
Oh, it's the worst.
It's the
I
same
never
sort of
want
thing. It's like, oh God, no.
Yeah.
Or someone.
Don't.
Yeah. How are you?
Compassion.
As you said, are you all right?
Yeah.
Or a hug. In those moments, it's like, it's enough to break it down. Like,
yeah.
You know?
And you know what's funny with me? I'm very good in those moments with other people.
With other people.
But not for myself.
No, we never are.
Why?
We never are.
Why?
We're experts when we're talking about somebody else. And I'm the best in the world at giving out advice.
Yeah.
I probably take about half it myself. And I know, like, I'm a walking contradiction in that sense in my behaviours too. In that I know what's the right thing to do and I know it and I've learned it through my own harsh experiences. But I don't always apply it to myself. Because then I go, fuck it. Just fuck it. And that's the worst for me when I go, fuck it. Because anything can happen then when I say
I was going to ask you what happens there.
Anything. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter where I go, what happens. I say fucking, I block it out because that's me using my psychotic. Because I have psychotic tendencies. Again, it comes from trauma and all that stuff.
Mm.
So I can turn on the psychotic. And the psychotic is good in the sense that the psychotic can get you hard times. And sometimes you need it to kind of numb yourself out and not feel. Because I can just go through a stage where I don't feel nothing.
Mm.
And I literally tell myself, don't feel nothing. And I just don't do it. So to get through certain things, like my grandfather's funeral, I just went, don't feel nothing. Pull it. That's it. Till it's over. Let's deal with the explosion afterwards. Just try to keep it together.
Mm.
Using that psychotic and that fuck it, but it's dangerous. You know what I mean?
Well, I was going to say, is that wise? Is it
no,
wise
No, it's not wise
that?
At
no.
all.
Yeah.
Not at all, you know? And it's not even about, and that's not even about repressing things. That's more about just ignore it for now. We'll get back to it. Because I know there's no ignoring it. I know you're going to get back to that no matter what. Mm. But the problem is you let things build up then and it's an explosion and it's very hard to put out a fire like when it's fucking the size of Hiroshima. You know what I mean?
Well, one thing that I wanted to ask you while we're talking about your grandfather, because actually I watched the Living with Lucy was back on just recently, right. So
yeah.
I watched it.
Yeah.
It's very good, but obviously your grandfather was in that and your grandmother as well.
Yeah.
Your grandmother, can we talk about her?
Yeah, yeah.
I just got a mad buzz that I was like, she has some kind of psychic ability when I was watching her on that show.
Oh, no doubt.
Oh, come on, we have to talk about it, please.
Like me,
because you know I had Teddy's.
Yeah, haven't listened to that. I'm going to listen to that. It was a good,
John,
great time.
Oh my God. Like, she literally, like, I was rattling on the chair.
Yeah.
Yeah, my grandfather came in, my grandmother was here, I got my mum on speakerphone, yeah. Colette was able to tell her stuff, like, that I didn't even know.
Oh,
it
yeah.
was wild.
Colette has the gift with her, though. Like, I remember
Seriously.
One time me and Teddy, this was about probably 2014 or something, 13 maybe, we came back from the Blacker. And we were going back to Teddy's mother and father's to retrieve a bottle of vodka in Teddy's room. We're like young kids, you know. And Teddy and, Teddy's mother and father, Willie and Colette, were in the kitchen and having the bottle of beer. And they're the loveliest people ever. Like,
yeah.
To be honest, like, the most hospitable, just beautiful, spiritual, welcoming people. Like, you walk into their place and it's just love. They're just beautiful people, like. And it's no wonder Teddy's the way he is, you know what I mean?
Like, that's exactly
just,
what I said to her last
good
rearing, week.
You know, really yeah,
absolutely,
really
good rearing,
rearing,
like. That's it, yeah, yeah.
And Colette said, John, there's someone beside you, you know. There's an old woman beside you. She's really dark. Is it a grandmother or maybe older? I think her name begins with N. That's my great-grandmother, Nan McCann.
Wow.
Serious, yeah? Yeah, mad. Yeah.
How were you in that moment when she said that to you?
I fucking loved it, yeah. I grew up with that. That's kind of my culture, so.
Yeah.
Look, it's hard for me to think of things objectively sometimes because I come from where I come from and my things and my beliefs and I grew up in a spiritual way, religious and spiritual, and I'm not religious now, but I'm definitely spiritual. And like my grandmother's a human lie detector, you know what I mean? So like I'd walk into my grandmother years ago and I'd just walk in and she'd be looking out the window smoking a fag, said, how are you, John? She wouldn't be looking at you. And what's going on with you? Look through you. I know what's going on with you. There's a girl, isn't there? And she does little things like this and she'd know everything. And I go, what the fuck, how do you know this, granny? You know I'm a witch, don't you? And she said, like, I remember when we were a child, you were younger than that, right?
Yeah.
Me, brother Joe used to go mental and whatever, and it was obviously after my father died and all that, so our behaviour went through a bad phase and whatever, and my mother, God help us, was dealing with a lot, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and my mother's a real big heart and empathy and a bit soft in that way as well. And she didn't know how to, she just wasn't dealing with us and our blackguard too well. So we were bringing about a lot of stress, right? And this in the old camp, we're probably about 10, 11. And we used to have no electricity, we'd only have it maybe for an hour or two at night. So my grandmother came in and there was no electric, so there was all lights were all out, and she came in and it was just me and Joe inside on the bunk, just sitting at the fire, you know.
Mm.
We'd be chatting away and she walked in and she says, how are you, boys? I said, oh, granny, how are you? But there was a weird, she just had her eyes and she wouldn't blink her eyes, and she sat down beside us and she was smoking a fag, and she kept smoking the fag and smoking, and we were looking at it and she's not dipping the ash, and she'd say, you know, only a witch can smoke it to the end without having it out. And we're going, granny, what did we do? Because we know we're up in shit, like. You're off little blackguards though, aren't you, with your mommy? Oh, granny, we're not going to do it. No, now listen to me carefully. Still hadn't dapped it the whole way down, like, dash, right? She said, you know I'm a witch, don't you? You know it, boy. So, yeah, granny, yeah. See, what I'm going to do is, if you don't stop messing with your mommy, I'm going to cut you up in a million pieces. I'm going to put you in a black bag. I'm going to put you at the end of my broom. I'm going to fly over the Liffey and drop you straight in the Liffey and no one will ever know. Granny, please, no, granny, no. So that's what I grew up with. Like, till I was about 15, I legitimately thought she's a witch. I still do in a different way.
Mm.
I would categorise her as a witch in a sort of a witch way, in that she's super, super intuitive.
Yeah.
Super,
yes,
super.
Yes.
Like, it's like everything else. People have different talents and some people are super intuitive. Their tools are so sharp with energy, with meeting people, with behaviours. They're like fucking psychologists untrained. You know what I mean? They just have that. And it's like the best fucking psychologists or psychotherapists are those people who are already like that. And then that's why that's why you get some psychotherapists just, you're like, you don't know shit. You know, you've just been trained educationally, you know that. But other people like Tiernan is someone who's super highly intuitive and then has the fucking education.
Yes.
So he's like the fucking Dalai Lama, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
On steroids. But Chrissy is sort of like that. So that's sort of that's the culture I grew up in. So I'm not skeptic like that.
Mm.
I know there are people like that. My mother is a bit as well like that. Super intuition, really high intuition. You know what I mean? And yeah, that's the way some people are.
Yeah, I love it because the intuition thing is really important. Because when Colette was here, she was saying, you know, that we're all mediums.
Yeah.
In some capacity, and yeah. She's saying, like, you know, you and Shane are mediums of podcasts, of
yeah.
You know, the medium of communication and different things. And she was talking about intuition and how, you know, we all have this like ability to have these gifts that, like, I would like medium gifts or whatever it is,
yeah.
And it's through the medium of intuition, and we all have it, but we just have lost touch with ourselves.
100%.
Do you know what I mean? So that
and it's
was like
a, it's like a form of intelligence as well. I mean, there's different types of intelligence. There's, like, you know, there's the problem solving, there's openness, you know, mm-hmm. which is one. There's all different ways of judging people on that sort of level, and some people are just super intuitive, and yeah. that helps in a like for instance, like if you were to being a good communicator, for one, right, is a type of intelligence. In that, if you are a really good communicator, you can you've probably so many avenues for a career to be mm-hmm. successful. And being intuitive is sort of like that as well. A really because you're a judger constantly of people, and you understand, you can observe behaviors, mm-hmm. and you can get into people, you know. So there's just different things. Like my little brother Paddy's like that. He's really intuitive as well.
Is he?
Yeah, he's really intuitive.
No,
like, yeah, he's like my brother Joe as well. Me, Joe, and Paddy were just blessed in a certain way. From bad shit to good shit and everything in between. And my father was a big part of it because my father was extremely intelligent, which is usually happens if anybody's schizophrenic. Usually these people who are schizophrenic are off the charts IQ.
Yeah.
So we got all that. My mother used to say, God help her, she used to say, you got it from your daddy. Or she'd go and the teacher would say, geez, the brain's the burn, Kathleen. Well, they got it from daddy, they didn't get it off me. You know, she, God help her, she got discouragement in school because when she went to school, teachers were telling her, you're going to make a good wife now and you can cook and clean one day, and that's it, the teachers would tell her. So they never encouraged sort of her education and her brains, whatever. But me and Joan Pike, you inherited that, and you can't, the thing about genes, you just can't really get away from the genes.
Well, I said, this is what I yeah. mean by saying to you earlier on, like, you must, like, you're like an encyclopedia of knowledge.
Only for the knowledge that
I don't think so.
It is, yeah.
I know you years now, and yeah. you can have a conversation on many, many subjects.
Half the time I'm just fucking
no,
winging
you're
it.
No, you're not.
Oh,
you're not.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm Googling under the table.
That's like, a little bit me.
Oh, well, I do that. Listen, do you ever just get on the Wikipedia page that follows you onto another one? And then you're like, you have a great amount of knowledge about a small, minute fucking subjects. Like, but yeah, no, look, I love learning. That's what it is. Mm. I love learning. But unfortunately, school was like, I just rebelled in school constantly. So I was like, I had, you know, the way the grades are like, I think it was poor, fair, good, very good, and then excellent.
Yeah.
So me and Joe would get excellent on everything, every single year, on every report card, except for behaviour and punctuality. Because we were rebelled against it. We just didn't like even being there.
Even though
I was interested in certain subjects. And then a load of other things got in the way. Like, we ended up, because we got segregated in school. Like, we got segregated and put in an all-traveller class, right? And I'll give you, it's kind of funny now when I think about it, right?
They don't still do that, do they?
They did it up until a couple of years ago. But I'll give you a laugh. So we did, it was usually the practice that when travellers did second class and they were to go to third class, usually the bigger school,
yeah,
they would then be put in an all-traveller school after they do the communion, you know? So we went over and we're like, me and Joe, like, doing, like, if our, off the charts fucking our tests every year, and we get put into this all-traveller class, and we're going, this doesn't make sense, you know? So the teacher, I'll never forget his name, I'm not going to say his name because he was a decent fella and it was just a part of the structure, he didn't know any better. But we went in and he gave us crayons, you know? Me and Joe looking at each other, like, my father would give me a newspaper at about 4 years of age and taught me to read it, you know what I mean? Before school even taught me. And he gave us crayons, and I went, sir, what are we doing with crayons? And he said, I'll draw a picture or something. And I said, okay, so we don't read in this class. And he goes, you can read. I said, I can read. I said, 100%, of course I can read. So he gives me a book, and I'll never forget it, Huggy Bear. And I said, sir, I was reading this 2 years ago. You can read that book. I said, yeah, sir, of course I can read fucking Huggy Bear. Like, so me and Joe were simultaneously started fucking reading Huggy Bear back to front. He said, Jesus, fair play to you. Look, there's other books if you want to read them over there, like, you know. So what happened was, we were there for about a month or two or more. And we didn't bother telling my mother because we were talking, we got it easier. But of course, me and Joe realised that we wanted something more intellectually challenging. You know what I mean? So we went back to my mother and we said, "Mommy, you know, just to let you know, we've been putting this all traveller class and we're just fucking doing crayons and shit like for the last month." And she said, "What?" So she went over and caused hell. And we left the class, the all traveller class, which there was just everybody of every different age, like from third class to sixth. And there was no structure around it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was mad. And then when me and Joe, the irony of the whole thing is, when me and Joe go and do the secondary school exam, which we weren't even going to do because we wanted to quit school, because our experiences were so bad in school, I tested. And in the school's history, it was like a 40-year history of the school, I was the highest tested student in their history. And my brother Joe was the second. And I was only beaten there 17 years later last year.
No way!
Yeah, because I was told by my old teacher came to visit me in a cup of tea. He went down to visit me to tell me your records had been beaten. Like, that's... So it's gas. But then I fucking went... I just went, fuck this education when I went to secondary school. Because my punctual problems and tendency and behaviour and all that stuff was... This is what's horrible about Irish education and secondary school in particular. They grade them in order of intelligence, the classes. So there's the... You know the way they did that? They do that in your school?
Yeah.
Like, that is fucking... That... Talk about setting people up for failure.
I was not up the top anywhere in those bloody classes.
But talk about setting someone up for failure and killing their self-esteem at a young age. Yeah. Are you crazy? Because I remember people... We were put in the highest class. And I remember people in my class calling, like, fucking people at the bottom, like Mongos and all. You know? Like, you can imagine what that fucking does. And so that was terrible. But what happened was, it was so fucking difficult that because I'd miss a week, I'd go back and they're talking about fucking this limestone and whatever, and then like, well, what the fuck, what's this limestone? And so, and then another 2 weeks would go by and they're talking about fucking the infiguous this and fucking that, and then I found that the only subjects I was able to still compute in was fucking English and history. So then I was going, fuck this. So then I just fucking start fucking just walking out of class randomly, you know? And then remember one day going, I was in a fucking French class. And I was going, what the fuck am I learning French for? I don't even know fucking Irish. I said, sir, I just went up to Mr. Cagney and said, I'm not doing this no more. What? I said, I'm not doing it anymore. You know the bridge downstairs? I'm going to wait there every time the French class on because I ain't learning fucking French. Fuck French. And then I just fell out of love with it. I started to feed into the kind of machoism of traveller culture and needing to go out and make money and be a man and use my hands and all that. You know what I mean? And I went away from education. And then a sort of acting kind of brought me back into education in a way, in that it just sparked all the curiosity up again. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. But isn't it funny how school just seems to teach people, or...
To teach people how to take exams.
Yes.
You don't teach people how to think for themselves.
Yeah, and the end product is most people leave school fucking hating learning, or the idea of learning.
Yeah, and
when learning is the key.
And that's the biggest complaint with fucking Irish, with the Irish language, is because it's taught in an academic way, and it should be taught more verbally if you actually want. What's the result here you want? If you want a society in which people speak the language more, how the fuck do you teach that? You teach it more verbally, of course, rather than in a written way all the time. That's why you see people now are so fascinated with Duolingo and that, because they're doing it more in a more verbal sort of way, you know?
Yeah.
So you're right, but I mean, the education system is fucked, but you know what it comes from, the education system we have in the programme we have.
No.
So in around...
The human encyclopedia is going to rant off some knowledge again.
Some stuff I read, whatever. But in around the mid-1800s, the British basically come up with an educational system that would produce the perfect British military gentleman. So you were like, why the fuck do we learn maths at any high-end level of maths? Like, what the fuck is that useful for? It's useful for because they had... the bombs, how would you describe the old school bombs, you know, the cannon fire.
Yeah.
The cannon fire, so it was a way to calculate with maths exactly how to hit them, where to hit them, whatever. So you taught maths because of that. You were taught French because it was the diplomatic language. You were taught English because to be a good English gentleman and have good writing, whatever, things like that. So the different subjects for that, they were giving you, the subjects were set up in order to create the perfect British military gentleman. And still to this day, that's what we're taught. And we're taught that in Ireland.
Are you taking the piss out of me?
No,
right,
honestly,
now?
That's
what?
That's the origin of it. That's the origin.
Honestly,
yeah, and it's obviously different here and there and bits and bobs, but it's essentially the same programming. That's what it's for.
Well, that's what it's for—a little indoctrination in your.
Yeah, that's what you have to remember. All our institutions are all inherited by the British anyway. Same with America, essentially, and then a different bit, and then you got their own constitution, of course. But we're all just versions of the Anglo. We're all just, you know, we're all anglicised, like. you know, and they were the rulers of the world. So, I mean, they were, yeah, they were good in education and other stuff and whatever. And then they just killed 150 million people worldwide, which is no harm. Like, never mind all the raping and pillaging and taking away of languages and culture and eradication of all that stuff. Like,
say no more.
My English friends.
I'm so ignorant to like our Irish culture. I really am.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I really am.
Well, Irish culture is constantly evolving. Like,
Our heritage, right? Yeah.
Well, what's important to know is this: that the people who fucking colonized this country weren't the fucking regular working class or normal people or even middle class people. It's the elites of Europe were the colonizers.
Yeah.
They're ones who are benefiting when they were sending their own poor people to the forefront of their wars. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's when republicanism comes, this sort of anti-English hate or people, that's fucking idiotic.
Mm-hmm.
That's stupid. Never mind wrong, which is obvious. But it's important to know it's about the elites. It's look at World War One. It was all fucking European elites, all the royalty starting it. Like, these caused the wars. It's the same people making money. The East India Company, all that. These were the people who were ruling the world, you know. They were a small, centralised group of people,
mm-hmm.
in which they created a sort of a facet, a lie, a culture around it to give people, empower people and whatever. You know what I mean? And it was all just sold on a lie. Who benefits from imperialism when you fucking elite people? You know?
Very true.
Only the conquerors.
Very, very true.
The conquerors.
Well, we're out of time.
We're out of time. There you go.
Before I let you go, I have a final question.
Hmm.
Well, it's a two-part question.
Okay.
What is your favourite quality about yourself? And the second part, what is the worst quality that you feel that you have?
Favourite quality about myself? I suppose... Can I give an extra answer as well?
You can do what you want. You're John Connors.
My favourite quality about myself is my openness to change. My favourite quality about other people is loyalty. And then my worst quality is self-sabotage.
Mm, really good. Can we just break down those three real quick?
So, because I know, I wouldn't say, even though loyalty is the biggest thing, like, you know, people
say... How does someone show you that they're loyal?
Just be loyal. Never fucking do me wrong. Stand by me. And because I've learned a lot about friends, so-called friends, in certain political stances I've taken over the years. And people who, not just mates, Lydia, because we've a lot of mates, you know. Mm-hmm. We've probably about five friends or whatever, or three or five, whatever. Mates and friends are different things. A lot of mates. But I had friends that when I was under the most stress, and I've had thousands of people hating me online, sending me death threats, calling me all sorts of names, giving me fucking panic attacks. And I hate even admitting, because it's like admitting that you're weak, but we all are weak at times, and that's mm-hmm. a fact. And it's embracing that too. But literally feeling like the world is going to end, and how am I going to get out of this fucking chaos? And my career is ruined, and my life is ruined, and they think this about me, and it's so inaccurate because I fucking love people, and why do you think I'm hating people? And I know. And then your fucking friend joins in and goes after you.
Mm.
And the last 2 to 3 years, that's why I said loyalty. I've learned a lot about loyalty in the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the best quality I like in others. You know. And I didn't name it for my own, because I just know I'm loyal anyway. That's just the way I am. It's mm-hmm. my nature. But for me, I think the reason why I chose openness is because if you stay open, you're constantly changing, you're constantly evolving, you're mm-hmm. constantly improving, you know what I mean? And you're just learning so much. And then that is, you adapt, you put that onto something else. You look through something else through a different lens, and it gets you to a different place. And you're going to a different place. It's learning, and it's fucking, I was a fucking idiot.
Yes.
I love that. When I go, fuck me, Jesus, what? 2015, I was some fucking idiot, wasn't I? Because then I know I'm evolving, like, you know what I mean? I don't want to look at 2015 and go, geez, you fucking knew it all. Jesus, you're mm-hmm. you're a smart fella. You still are a smart fella. You know what I mean? I don't want to stop that. You know what I mean?
That's it. Yeah, you don't want to look back 5 years ago and be the same person.
No, you don't. You want to constantly think you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
one last thing, a little bit of controversial one. I just want to say, right?
Go on.
I don't know if it's controversial at all, but fuck it, I'll get it in. Could be seen to. Well, the left won't like it. Put it that way. The tolerable left. They're talking about fucking getting a turn, putting the voting age down to 16, right? Which all the lefties wants. And it seems to be all across the board you want in Ireland now. And who's left and right and whatever in Ireland now anyway. Let me tell you. When I was 16, I was a fucking idiot.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know me fucking arse from me elbows. And I was fucking, just had a fucking constant erection looking for women. And fucking, you know what I mean? Like, honestly, like, that's the truth. Any 16-year-old boy
has
energy.
Have you curtailed that hankering?
Now I don't even care. But seriously, now the 16-year-old today, these cunts who fucking don't even go around street corners looking for women, they're just in WhatsApp groups and everybody's stuck to their phone and they're fucking narcissistic to the core. You want them little cunts to go into a fucking voting booth and vote who runs the fucking country? Are you fucking... If anything, I put the voting up to 21. If any fucking
You were saying that and I was thinking anything. That. 25.
Yeah.
So for judging on personal experience.
I know whatever we're saying, we were connected to something there that got me to that voting age that sparked that. But
we're talking about change and evolving as humans.
Yeah, exactly,
exactly.
Basically, when I was 16, I was a fucking idiot. And that's being polite to myself. So please don't allow fucking narcissistic social media, Instagram or arses fucking up and vote and fucking on fucking policy in this country.
Well, I would agree with that one. I think 16 is too low. What does that make me now? Am I a rightist now if I say this?
Let me say this right. You are a racist.
A racist?
Because it doesn't matter if it's not got to do with race. You're still a racist, like.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah. Everything is racist, even if it's nothing got to do with race.
But listen, very, very final quip.
Yeah.
If you were to give your 16-year-old self advice, what would you give?
What would you say? God, like, honestly, like, if I'm giving it to, say, a 16-year-old, give it. If I'm giving it to actual me, John Connors, I wouldn't give him any advice. I'd let him go where he had to go. But to any 16-year-old, I would say, calm the fuck down. Realize that what other people think about you does not affect you in any way and should not affect you in any way. Mm-hmm. And find what you want to do in your life, your purpose in life, and have fun doing it, and you're in no fucking hurry to do it.
Amazing.
That's what I would say to a 16-year-old.
Will you write a book?
But not John Connor's 16-year-old. I'd say you just keep destroying yourself to find that pain where the yard was born and all that. Hello.
Really, really good. Thank you so much. So when can we look forward to the Back Wealth being out?
Well,
it's in production now, right?
It's in editing, so we're... usually 6-7 months ahead of the film, but we're looking to do it in basically fucking 6 weeks. So we're near, like, so we're living in the edit. So I hope we're trying to make the Venice deadline. I think 31st.
How exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, you're such an actor.
Well, Venice, I'd love to. It's the oldest film festival in the world. So,
and have you gone to it before?
No. And it's the top three kind of, it's Cannes, Venice and Berlin, and then there's Sundance and Toronto and a few others, like a good few others that are top. Look, I'd be happy to get in the top 20 festivals, but to get into Venice, because we've the kind of Italian connection with Dante's Inferno and the Black Wealth and all that, and they seem to love films about sort of Catholic repression. The Magdalene Sisters actually won the Golden Lion, the top award in Venice, so I think stylistically in the story, we suit Venice, so if I get there, my God, I'm going to be so happy.
I'll be so happy for you. I'll be bloody thrilled.
Yeah, but if not, it'll find its way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. As does everything.
Exactly.
And Ireland's Call, is it coming back?
Look, I'm open to that because, you know why? Because why fucking not? And now after COVID, all they're going to be looking for is fucking one-man shows, one-woman shows. That's all they're looking for now.
Yeah.
So there's not big
and the crowd will be outside.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. So if they're fucking looking and they're paying the cash, you know, who knows? Yeah, let's go and heal some more. Why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was blown away that night that I went.
Ah, it cheers. Was like, cheers. Yeah, it really was. It's great. And that's a show that's constantly evolving. I did it 85 times, like all across the world. So I'd love to keep doing it. Get the 100 mark anyway, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, John
Connors.
Thanks, family,
Lillian.
I appreciate it. That was great.
Hold up. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.